Hello listeners, my name is Kieran Stuart Ashton and you're listening to another episode of Earth Matters. Produced in the studios of 3CR down on Kulin Lands in Naam and broadcast nationally across the Community Radio Network. So today we're going to be having a yarn to a friend and comrade of mine, Matt from Basalt Buddies. Basalt Buddies is a pretty great organisation, but I'll let Matt explain it a bit better. How you going, Matt?
Yeah, good mate. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Cheers for coming on. So you do a lot of work with Basalt Buddies. Just for the listeners, do you want to give a brief overview of what Basalt Buddies actually is?
Yeah, sure. So Basalt Buddies, the spiel is we're a loose collective of friends and comrades spiralling the penumbra of grassland advocacy in the inner west and inner north of Naam. We have two backyard nurseries where we grow what we kind of call hyper-local provenance plants. So not just species from our area, but species grown from seeds and plant material taken from as close to home of those remnant sites as possible. We sell the plants cheap. We donate some. We're working on having a kind of living seed bank library so that we can keep producing those seeds, seeds and plants into the future. And, you know, if anything goes wrong in those local ecosystems, we've got a bit of a backup that isn't tied to any government or private entity.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really important work that you do, especially, you know, that whole hyper-local. Sorry, what was the term you just used?
I used hyper-local.
Yeah, hyper-local, yeah.
We changed up a bit. Local, hyper-local.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people call it like the 30-kilometre radius rule.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you start going further away than that, it may technically be the same species. Also, we might find out one day it's not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's also something that I often get a bit of a bee in my bonnet about is cultivars. Like it's so good that you're doing work with the actual proper, you know, native species and not all of these cultivars that you see quite a lot of nurseries and stuff producing these days. Just for the listeners, if you don't know what cultivars are, they're essentially a genetically modified version of a natural species, or, you know, any species really, but essentially a genetically modified version. And then don't actually occur naturally out in nature or anything like that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of future potential problems with cultivars, especially when they escape people's yards and get out into the bush and start hybridizing with the native species.
Yeah, for sure. What is it? Joey from Crime Pays calls them horticultural atrocities, which is funny because a lot of people ask when they see our nursery and find out what we do and they're all impressed, they're like, so you're a horticulturalist? And it's like, no, we're not. But they often come to us with questions. There is an art to growing plants, and there are some tricky ones that we haven't fully got down yet. But a lot of those courses tend to still point people in the direction of growing mass flowering plants, like you said, that aren't the natural occurring ones, and cultivated lawns.
Yeah, it's very annoying. But yeah, just a bit more quickly about Basalt Buddies. So the majority of plants you do, that would be from the Victorian grassland plains?
Yeah, yeah. So a couple of us live in Braybrook, and we have some organisers in Epping. And so, yeah, the sites we focus on, we're pretty lucky to have some good connections with people working on private sites and already growing the plants from those areas, so that we're not having to take too much from those kind of threatened and vulnerable ecosystems. And so those areas are like St Albans, Derrimut, Sunshine, these kind of places.
Mm. And I was actually reading the other day a pretty shocking statistic, something like only 2% of the grasslands remain. 98% of the grasslands have been wiped out.
Yeah, it's a kind of the number jumps around a little bit between less than 1% and 2%, because a lot of that survey work is being done by volunteers that are stretched. And then we also have to kind of define what is still a grassland. Yeah. If it's a big property that's been grazed by sheep for 200 years, there might still be grassland values there, but is it still, does it still count towards the greater survival?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. One of the main reasons I wanted to get you on the show today was to talk a bit about some failed green policies that have been pushed by governments such as the Labor government. In particular, the way that these green policies, you know, they might, if you don't know any better, they might seem good at, you know, first value or you know, when you first read about them. But then when you actually have a little bit more of a look into how they function and what their outcomes would be, turns out they're not actually so great after all. But yeah, is there any particular policies, I suppose, that you would want to touch on?
Yeah, so I might put a pause on the specific policies for right now and just give a bit more context to that those criticisms. It seems from my point of view, so I should say I don't work in the industry. I do a lot of volunteering, which has its own kind of benefits because I end up working on sites that are very special and only certain people would get paid to work there. We should give a quick shout out to the Bushworkers Collective because we're going to be talking a little bit about unpaid labour today. But the people in that industry have their own fight to earn a good living wage and good safety practices. Looking down at the conservation work being done on this state, so-called Victoria, the pieces start to come together that the Labor government has essentially structured the conservation in a way that the future of threatened ecosystems and species are essentially held at ransom for their continuation of power. So we have, if we talk about birds and mammals, we have more breeding programs than actual protection of their native habitat. So for as long as they can keep churning out new specimens of these species, they can keep holding up their banner of no new extinctions and saying they did their job. If we look at plants, which are a kind of even more extreme example, there could be a plant that only is still holding on in one little stronghold. They managed to breed 20,000 of them and pop them all around the state, and this critically endangered plant now goes down to slightly threatened. And some examples of those plants might be ones that historically, if they were found in an area, would guarantee that area protection. But if they are able to germinate and spread around enough plants that they start to look like weeds, then that area that was originally slated for protection has a bit less armor.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty insidious when you really think about it. And it's so destructive as well, you know, like replacing actual conservation of areas and, you know, natural cycles with these stuff like breeding programs and, you know, these other programs to mass produce plants and just scatter them anywhere. It's not conservation at end dates.
Yeah, it's and it is a part of it in the short term.
Yeah.
But if they're not going back to healthy protective ecosystems, it's, I don't know, churning them out into the meat grinder.
Yeah, yeah.
And so one like specific example of that, we all celebrated a couple of years ago when the grassland earless dragon was seen again for the first time in, I think, 60 years, something like that. It was found in a property, I won't say where, but further than Melton. And the people who own that property are older farmers. So they originally found a couple of lizards on the first day and came back with Zoos Victoria and found a bunch more. And so there's now an ongoing breeding program with them there. The people who own that property is an older farming couple, and they want to sell that property, but they now know that it has this lizard habitat, and so they know they need to sell it to the right people.
Yeah, yeah.
They've been petitioning the Labor government to buy that property off them and create some sort of conservation work on the ground there, and they can't get a call back.
Yeah, it's typical, I suppose, of the Labor government. It's not good, you know, at the end of the day. It's just a structure. It's ongoing destruction of ecosystems.
Yeah.
And yeah, it needs to stop. And it's something that we're seeing, no doubt, right across the continent, not just across the state of Victoria.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, all my examples are going to be local examples, but maybe the listener will prick their ears up and go, well, that's kind of happening over there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess that's, yeah, one other thing that I felt it was worth. I like having a chat with you, but I thought it was worth putting myself on the airways for is maybe the antithesis to those conservation activities being tied so heavily to capital and the Labor government is us properly getting to know the areas around where we live, right down to knowing what species are meant to be there, what isn't meant to be there, what's healthy this year, what was healthy last year. And once we're comfortable that we can make an impact on them, making that impact, because a lot of people in the industry get a bit timid to invite people in that don't have the knowledge and understanding, and there's a very good reason for that. But if things keep on the trajectory that they are, you'll just end up gatekeeping and protecting nothing.
Yeah, you know,
one little tiny patch saying, no, you need to be a professional to work here. I think maybe a much healthier outcome is that you have suburbs of people where a bunch of them are doing a day a fortnight, whether it's in an official friends of group, whether they're doing similar stuff to us and preserving those plants in their backyard, you know, clean up days. It's all a little bit boring to talk about, but that's what caring for country is. That's what healthy ecosystems is. It's the ongoing connection that was taken from mob and all your people.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, what we need to get back to, because, you know, as you're saying, like, if everyone was doing it in a neighborhood, or even if, you know, it wasn't everyone, even if it was like a large percentage of people in the neighborhood were doing it, then we wouldn't see half of these amount of problems that we're seeing. And something else I'd also add on to that is that you kind of touched on there at the start a bit, is about how we're planting plants that aren't necessarily actually endemic to that area.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this all the time. You know, people think, you know, it's a native plant because it's native to, you know, so-called Australia, but that doesn't mean it actually grew there traditionally, you know. It doesn't mean it's been there for more than, you know, 200 years tops sort of thing. And we see this all over the place. You know, up on my country, up on the east coast of, oh, the south coast, sorry, of New South Wales, we've got a lot of problems now where a lot of the coastal variants of plants, like, you know, your coastal banks, your own coastal tea tree and stuff like that, they're spreading further inland into regions and, you know, ecosystems that they would have never traditionally grown in. It's just because, you know, the whole system has been so disturbed that these plants that are used to growing in, you know, sandy, you know, low nutrient soils, they just take a hold and spread like weeds once they get into those more fertile soils where, yeah, you used to have established eucalypt woodlands or, you know, whatever it might have been. And not only that, like, we see so much of the councils and stuff doing it as well. Like, one really great example that I've seen a lot of down here is a lot of Sydney wattle down here. And when it flowers, it doesn't actually line up with the breeding cycles or, you know, the major food cycles of any of the native bugs down here.
Right.
But sure. It feeds all the introduced bugs, yep. Like all the pest bugs down here get a mad feed off this Sydney wattle, which isn't traditionally from here. And, you know, most people think that they're doing the right thing planting a native because it's, you know, it's a native apparently. Never mind the fact that it comes from 1,000 kilometres away.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and, this whole way that we define nativity.
Yeah, and it gets right down to, you touched on it there, it gets down right down to the kind of hyper-local thing where a certain type of bee might only come up from ground or do its life cycle 1 month of the year.
Mm.
And like you said, it might be looking for acacia and this Sydney wattle's already finished flowering.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got to go further. Hopefully there is one before it runs out of steam. And yeah, and the thing you touched on about plants that might be native to an area pretty close by but are now encroaching on these ecosystems, there's not really anything we can do to stop that process at the start. The world's a busy and complicated place and seeds are going to be spreading around in ways that they traditionally didn't. We can't ask everyone to stay home and check their shoes every time and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's little things we can do, but really there's not much. And so that's where we go back to understanding your local ecosystem. Maybe you walk through it one day and you're like, that little Banksia seedling's pretty, but it's not meant to be here.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it has to come out.
And, you know, there's so many examples of that as well. It's just, can't stress enough, just learn your local ecosystem and, you know, look at the local plants that are supposed to be there and help prop up that local environment. You know, at the end of the day, these other plants from other areas, you know, they might look beautiful, but there's plants that are just as beautiful where you're from. And, you know, you can find something for your garden, surely, that comes from the local area.
Just another example that popped in my head when we were talking about government environmental policy. There's this word that everyone has a different reaction to, especially in Victoria, and it's called offset. And so there's a couple of different definitions of an offset. And when you're talking about a specific species, you might call a population an offset population because you've planted it there for insurance in case natural disasters happen and its original home isn't there. You've got a healthy population from it to take to and bring back home. And it gets a bit murkier after that, or a bit more sinister after that, I should say. And so an offset site generally means a piece of land that the government has promised protection for in exchange for destroying something else.
Mm.
So we're going to develop this whole suburb, but we're going to buy this big block of farmland and turn it into a conservation reserve, or whatever words they choose to use for it. And it's just so short-sighted in every way, but in small ways, like the people in government now, even if the party name's the same, then won't be the same people in 10 years. So it's these kind of like whispered promises that in most cases often don't eventuate into good outcomes. We see that all the time in the western suburbs. We have a larger advocacy network called the Grassy Plains Network that does a lot of kind of petitioning and negotiating to minimize the impacts of the development out there. But what the reality of that kind of 20-year offset program is now that the government has bought a lot of land with this developer money to turn into the Western Grassland Reserve, but it's the habitat value is barely a percentage of what they've destroyed. A lot of it's degraded farmland, a lot of it's land that's just been held in private equity to go up in value. And the third kind of offset we're seeing, similar to the second one but less tied into development, is artificial wetlands and these sort of things where we're repatriating old dumping sites or sewage sites, planting the species we think should go there and hoping it all takes care of itself. And I bring that one up because there's an announcement sometime last year that somewhere in the state, I think Northwest, but I could be wrong, they're putting a bunch of money into repatriating an old sewage site, and they're saying it's going to be habitat for swift parrots and leadbeater possums, two of our most critically endangered species. And presumably they're going to put them there because I don't think you're expecting them to just casually find this place. And so it ties back into this like kind of living outdoor zoo, no new extinctions policy stuff they've got going on, where it's not necessarily bad in itself, but it doesn't mean anything without the greater protection of natural habitats and ecosystems. And I also think it's a little bit naive to think that human hands can build an ecosystem that will survive the test of time from scratch.
Definitely. And, you know, it's another big thing as well that I suppose if you're not in the industry, a lot of people don't really understand, but there's a massive difference between conservation and restoration. Now, when you've got conservation, you've got a, for the most part, intact ecosystem that you're trying to conserve and you're trying to, you know, keep healthy. But when you're doing restoration, it's a massive whole uphill battle that isn't always successful either. You know, there's, there's a lot of times when people try and restore a site and they just can't because, you know, as you said, like they're trying to build an ecosystem from scratch as humans.
If you're a multi-millionaire, you might have a few more tools at your disposal, like rabbit-proof fences, predator traps, cameras, all these kind of stuff. But there's still things that we don't understand and can't control yet. The bacteria in the soil, the mycorrhizae in the soil, particularly when we talk about orchids, they often can't survive without those things. So yeah, I think the best we can do is build something that looks like it and functions like it. And that's better than doing nothing if that land is degraded. But I really think we have to reconnect with the pieces that have survived the test of time. Connect with them, learn from them, talk to people, try to find out who is working there, whether it's volunteer or industry working there, because, you know, those people have plenty of stories and knowledge to share with you about the site. And the end result of all this is that we're falling back in love with the place we live in a kind of childlike way. Even if we're going down to a remnant patch of grassland with no idea of what we're going to do that day, and you go, oh, I haven't seen that flower here before. It hasn't been logged on iNaturalist before. I wonder if anyone even knows it's here. And it builds that love and kind of protection that, depending on what the future of this country looks like, the protection side might be pretty important, whether it's through neglect or through changes in policy that says, actually, this has no value to the government anymore.
Yeah, I can't stress enough that, you know, people, listeners out there should, you know, if you care about the environment, if you care about the climate and about the ecosystems and plants and animals and whatever else.
If you've ever said, I love this country.
If you've ever said that, go and show that you love it and, you know, actually put in some work. There's, you know, these volunteer groups exist right across the continent, or these, you know, various different friends of such and such creek or reserve or grassland or wood or whatever it might be. And if there's no volunteer group in your area, get some like-minded friends and comrades together and create one. You know, get out there and start doing some work. And, you know, you might not be perfect at it, but something's better than nothing at the end of the day. And something I've actually, like, kind of come a bit of a conclusion to over the last couple of years, sounds a bit doom and gloom, but, like, you know, it's the reality as I see it is, you know, we're already in climate collapse. We're already in ecosystem failure. We're already seeing these mass extinction events and, you know, the world's already gone down the toilet. What we can do now, you know, it's too late to stop any of this stuff. You know, it's too late for the most part to rewind a lot of this stuff as well. But what we can do is try and save what still remains, you know, so that we do have actually something worth fighting for. And, you know, we do have something for the future. If and when, you know, we manage to somehow get out of this system and we manage to get out of this collapse that we're living through now, you know, we're going to need something to build upon and to build, you know, some stores to build back on. And in that regard, you know, I believe that conservation work's actually some of the most important work that anybody could be doing, because, you know, without all that conservation work that goes on behind the scenes, at the end of the day, we're going to be left with nothing. You know, we're going to be left with no plants, no animals, no ecosystems. Our entire climate's just going to continue to get worse. We're not going to be able to even feed ourselves or, you know, produce water for ourselves without these ecosystems. And yeah, it's just a very important thing, in my opinion.
For sure. And if those things that you're talking about eventuate, the government will be putting their hands up and disappearing into the hedges anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So whether we're on track for a speedy decline or a slow decline, I don't think anyone's coming to save us but ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's plenty of us, and we all meet new good people all the time.
So if anyone out there is listening and they do want to support the work that you do or get involved, what's the best way for them to do that? Is there, you know, a way for people to donate or for people to sign up to volunteer? Or
if people just want to contact us directly because you've got any questions about today, you can contact us at basaltbuddies@gmail.com. We do have a little website. It's more of a store, but we're working on putting out a few more newsletters. And it's in the link at Instagram, at basaltbuddies. You should be able to find the website through there and sign up to the mailing list. As for donations, we're not really calling for donations at the moment, but we're trying to grow enough plants to sell them cheap and keep funding everything we do. So that's going well. We just planted, I think, about 20 more trays the other day with 10 species in it that we haven't grown before. So that should take us up to having about hopefully 50 species of the local flowering plants in our, nice, our living library. We're chatting with a local community garden about setting up a seed production area there. And that all seems to be going positive for now, which will, you know, just free us up more and more room, especially with something like a seed production area. It can be quite automated. So it's a kind of a little bit of effort at the start and then not much going forward. And you have that kind of seed bank to keep taking from and storing.
Yeah, yeah.
What about you? What do you got going on?
Yeah, a bit, actually. So I actually have another job outside of radio, where I work in conservation myself. Less so the actual hands-on conservation work, although I definitely do get the opportunity every so often and do enjoy going out, you know, planting plants and doing the weeding and whatever else. I actually work as a conservation education ranger, where I take a lot of mob, you know, not just Aboriginal kids but Aboriginal adults as well, and try and, you know, upskill them a bit in conservation and get them connecting back to country and looking after country that way. So yeah, that's been really good, actually. I've been there for about 6 months or so now, and it's just so fulfilling, you know, being able to actually get out there and work on country and, you know, get your hands dirty, and not only that, pass on these skills to the next generation of people.
Yeah, and when you have the numbers, it happens. You can do a lot of work fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that's not true when you're starting in a bad place, but once you're a couple of years into a project, and you've got enough people and passion there, you almost just emu walk through and then turn around and look at the difference you've made in, you know, half a day with 10 people in a small space sort of thing. And once you get it to that state, it's getting close to being able to look after itself.
Yeah.
And the next year you might be able to walk through twice as fast.
Yeah.
Especially if, you know, you're able to get burning regimes and stuff like that. You can help it look after itself. The hard work is kind of undoing the damage that's been done at the start.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up?
There was something that came to my mind. So we've tried to be a little bit positive while talking about some doom and gloom stuff, and I guess maybe that makes me concerned that we're just basing this off paranoia, and that we're just thinking about the worst case scenario so people listen to us on the radio. I got an email last week from someone who works out east in orchid conservation. And the title, it was passed on to me. I don't know this person personally, so I won't say their name, but it says, "Sad news from out east. I'm not sure if you are aware. I have very reliably been informed that a recent restructure, all funding and staff in DECA," so that's the Department of Environment, Energy, Conservation, something like that, "the people you have to fight against to make good things happen," although I'm sure some very good people work in that industry and wish it was different. "Staff in DECA that have been doing any projects of biodiversity have been halted. All staff involved have been moved to doing other things. This involves maintenance or no new works to protect fencing and monitoring of the threatened species." And there's some photos in it. A recent excursion to Mundi Plains, Eastern Nunyong Plateau. The fence that had been there was missing and the entire site was trashed from horses and deers. You know, that's obviously a rumor type email, but one of the people I know who does seed collection, they normally have a kind of year by year conversation with DECA out east about collecting seed from specific plants that they want to only take as little as possible. And so they're in conversation, is this a good year sort of thing? They don't answer their calls anymore. That started after the fires. They were saying, "Oh, the fires across northern Victoria means that, you know, don't bother calling us for 3 months. Talk to you in 3 months." And then in the meantime, we're now hearing there's restructuring and kind of an uncertain future. And that could turn out to be fine, but it might not. The most conservation type contracts need to be applied for every 3 years. So funding for a specific site to keep paying workers and bring in volunteers, those are very short contracts and things can change very fast. And we both hope they don't. Let's get thinking about it and let's get out and explore and learn.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's such a precarious situation too, you know, the way these funding packets work and the way that they're so short term. And at the end of the day, you know, at the whims of whoever's elected. You know, like as you were saying earlier, you know, we might have these same parties in 10 years' time that have got the same names, but it's going to be completely different politicians.
For sure. It's like talking to your landlord, get everything in writing. Because they might make you believe that they're coming to fix the kitchen sink, and then the house gets sold and the new guy doesn't want to do it.
Yeah, yeah. All right. It's been great having you on, though. A lot of good but also bad things to discuss and talk about.
Yeah, it's the world we've inherited.
Yeah.
Just quickly shout out to some of the crews I work with, especially the people out at Irimu. It's kind of the unpaid labor capital of grasslands, at least as far as my eyes can see. But it's really cool that Rick and Megan and the crew there have been able to. So that was originally a grassland, but then it became a munition site. And 20 or 30 years ago, it was cleaned up a bit, and they've worked on restoring that to what is now a really good example of a healthy living grassland. And even if it maybe is less natural and remnant than it once was, it's an example where people can come in and go, "Wait, I didn't know about any of this stuff. Tell me more. I got questions. You know, what are the next steps? How do I make that rundown conservation site at the end of my street look more like this?"
Yeah, yeah. Quick shout out to the Community Broadcasting Foundation, as well as to 3CR down in Naarm, where this show is produced. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, have a good one.